Hey folks, it's Jed Wolpaw here with just a quick message. We have switched over to a new platform, and you may start hearing some ads along with the episodes. This is really a way that we can continue to pay the growing cost of the services we need to keep the podcast coming to you without having to charge listeners. So we really want to keep the content free, and so we're going to start introducing some ads, and so if you hear them, you'll know what's going on. All right, thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the show.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw and I am really excited because we have a fantastic show for you today. I think it's going to be super useful and really give us some information about some new technologies that you're going to be seeing and that are going to really play a role. And this is going to give you information you need to be able to handle that well in your practice. We are going to talk about non-transvenous ICDs and pacemakers. So really interesting stuff. So I have three guests with me today, which is also fun because it's always fun to have some more people. And they're really experts on this. They've got an article coming out about this. And so I think they're going to be really useful. I've got with me, first of all, Dr. Mike Essendo, who is a cardiothoracic anesthesiology attending at Ohio State. He's a full professor of cardiovascular anesthesiology. He's also the assistant dean of graduate medical education there. And he is involved very much both in clinically in this, and he's also an advisor for Boston Scientific and for S4 Medical. Now, we do want to disclose those up front because obviously we'll be talking about some devices that those companies are involved in, but obviously we're not advertising them, and he's actually going to be just doing some of the introduction. It's his fellows, who I'll introduce in a minute, who are going to be talking about the devices. So we also have a couple of fantastic fellows from Ohio State, and I should actually say the Ohio State University with us as well. So we have Dr. Joseph Cody and Dr. Thomas Grawl, and they go by Joe and Tommy. And as I said, they're cardiothoracic anesthesiology fellows at the Ohio State University. They don't have any disclosure. So gentlemen, it is really a pleasure. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jed.
Thank you.
So I want to start, Mike, with you. And if you could just kind of give us an introduction, why did this come up? How did you guys decide to write a review on this? And why do you think it's important for folks to know about?
All right. So I'll start off by saying thank you for, inviting us. This is it's an honor. It's a great opportunity for us to share some of the work that we're doing at Ohio State. So I'll say this, I'll preface by saying, cardiac rhythm management has advanced over the years. We've stayed in the transvenous space for a long time, but transvenous leads come with a lot of complications. And the Society of Cardiovascular Anesthesiologists basically started this initiative where they wanted a few of us to create like a video. We did like a webinar and recorded it and put it on the SCA website to share with other centers on these newer technologies. When we did this about 2 months ago, it focused predominantly on the SICD, which is just one of the non-transvenous devices. And after we did that video, we received a lot of emails from physicians around the globe just saying how useful it's been for them to learn from what we shared. But I discussed it with, my great fellows, and they felt that I limited it to just one device. They felt that, you know, the SICD is just one device. There are other devices like the Micra, the, you know, the NanoStim, just which we will go through all these devices in detail. And they're like, how do people know the functionalities of these devices? And how do they know how to manage it perioperatively? And when, as we kept talking, we realized that, you know, the latest document from the ASA, I didn't spend much time on these novel devices. And I must, you know, disclose that I did help with that document, you know, a little bit by reviewing the final document and making some edits. But the ASA's approach is the most of these devices, like the literature they use to create these documents have to be evidence-based and have to be, you know, vetted, and the devices have to be trialed and tested. However, the way the EP space evolves rapidly, there's no way for us, you know, anesthesiologists to have any quote unquote evidence-based data guiding the management of these devices. So my fellows pushed me and we basically communicated with the Journal of Cardiothoracic and Vascular Anesthesiologists, and we assembled a group of physicians from, you know, reputable centers with a lot of clinical experience on these non-transvenous devices. So it was a Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Hargrave, Dr. Cronin from UCSD, Dr. Dahlia from MGH, Dr. Strackenbacher from MGH, and Dr. Augustidis from Penn. And we collaborated we used like the modified Delphi methodology to basically share what experiences we have from all these high volume centers, and then share how we've been managing these devices. And I would say it was very refreshing when we collaborated, you know, and then came up with this document. It took a lot of work. The industry supported us a lot. Medtronic, Boston, all of them gave us images to include in this article. And I think it's a very comprehensive article. It's the only one out there that would help guide anesthesiologists to manage patients with these novel devices. So this is, you know, how we came up with this review article.
That's great. And I'm thrilled that you guys did it. I love that it's going to have images. I think that'll be super helpful for people. We will put a link to the abstract in the show notes. The article itself, I think, is not yet out, so we can't actually put that in there, but it will be out fairly soon. And so at that point, people will be able to look it up, and they'll have the abstract to go by until then. So thank you to you, your co-authors, for putting this together. So Tommy, let me turn to you. Give us a little bit. I think even though listeners will know that we did a while back, we did a full episode on pacemakers and AICDs with one of our then EP fellows here at Hopkins. But I think it would still be useful to do a little review of what the current technology is, so that people can remember that, or there may be folks who don't know. Let's do a little bit of an overview. Take us through that. What are pacemakers for? Maybe let's start there. What are they for? Why do people have pacemakers?
So the basics really is a pacemaker does two things. It's going to sense the voltage produced by the heart, and then it's going to pace the heart if it's programmed to do so. And really, for the most part, except for a few exceptions, a pacemaker is going to be treating bradycardia, whereas an ICD, short for internal cardioverter defibrillator, is going to be treating tachyarrhythmias.
Okay, great. So we've got pacemakers, we've got ICDs, and then we've got devices that do both, right? Okay, so what are the basic components of a traditional pacemaker, and how is it implanted?
Sure. So a traditional pacemaker is what a lot of people would also call a transvenous pacemaker, because it has two parts. It has a generator, and that sits in the subcutaneous tissue on the chest, usually on the left side. You can usually see it or feel it. And then it has the wire leads, and those are wired from the generator transvenously through the subclavian SVC and then into the heart. And those are placed by the cardiologist in the EP lab.
And just out of curiosity, and folks, you know, there may be even people who have done this, have done the anesthesia for these, and don't know the actual ins and outs. How are those leads actually placed? How do they get them into the actual vessels?
So it's the same as you would do for like a central line. You basically get a venous stick and then you do a modified Seldinger, and eventually they dilate up and they'll thread the wire through, and under fluoro, they guide it to the appropriate spot, whether it's the RA, the RV, or the coronary sinus.
Great. Okay. And this is happening on the venous side.
Correct. All venous side.
Great. All right. And so that's how it's implanted. And then, obviously there must be some downsides to this, right? Or else nobody would be out there trying to come up with non-transvenous approaches. So what are some downsides to the way it's currently done?
Yeah, you're right. There actually are a lot of downsides. So I like to break them down to immediate and long-term. Immediate, as with any vascular procedure, you can have a pneumothorax, vascular injury. The leads can become dislodged, and you can also perforate the heart and get a tamponade. And then the long-term complications can be pretty nasty. You can get central venous obstruction, such as SVC syndrome. You can get tricuspid valve injury from the leads. The leads can become fractured or damaged. You can get infection in the pocket or endocarditis. And anyone that's done a lead extraction knows how nasty those can be. In fact, just this week, we had a lead extraction where the RV was perforated and patient coded and put on ECMO and all that. So definitely a lot of complications that can happen with these. And with over 200,000 of them being placed in the U.S. every year, it can really add up.
Yeah. And clearly this must not be, a kind of once in a blue moon thing, or else, again, there wouldn't be the incentive for these companies to be developing new ones. So do we have any feel for, how common some complication is? I mean, how, if you look at, a thousand people who get a pacemaker, we don't need to go into sort of every possible complication, but just how common is it to get some sort of complication?
I think one of the articles I looked at, major complication rate was 8.8%.
Wow.
So it definitely a significant amount can experience major complications.
Yeah,
I don't have the exact numbers of all the individual things, but
yeah, no, that's fine. And that's striking. I mean, that's a high rate of a major complication, right? We're not talking about, pruritus over the pocket. We're talking about major mm-hmm. complications, and that's not insignificant. So that makes sense that there's a need for more. Let's back up a bit and just do a little bit of review again, because mm-hmm. pacemakers have their own kind of terminology and people may or may not be familiar. So I think it's worth reviewing. Can you talk about, let's say you got a patient coming in, they've got a pacemaker. How do you know what mode it's in? If they come in and they say, oh, I'm in, DDD or, VVO, how do you know what those letters mean?
Sure. So most patients, if they're established in your system, you should be able to pull up their interrogation reports, which they usually have every few months done by the cardiology people. And that report can give you a lot of valuable information. It'll tell you what mode they're in, how often their pacer dependent. If they have an ICD, it'll tell you if there's been shocks delivered. So those can be really useful. But if you don't have those, you can always call one of the reps and they can come interrogate it. And it only takes a couple minutes really for them to be able to do that with their machine. As far as the letters go, as the type of pacemakers go, there's really three. We've got a single chamber pacemaker, and that's where the lead either goes in the RA or the RV. And then we've got a dual chamber pacemaker. That's with two leads in the RA and the RV. And then the last type is a biventricular pacemaker. And this is something you might have heard of as cardiac resynchronization therapy. And this is basically a patient, usually the indication is someone with a reduced EF and a prolonged QRS. So if you see someone and they have a biventricular pacemaker, you can kind of say right away, okay, I know this person probably at least at some point had a reduced EF. And the way that they pace the left ventricle at the same time as the right is they put that lead into the coronary sinus and that paces the left ventricle. So the theory is when you have that synchrony of pacing both ventricles at the same time, it improves your EF.
Great. And that makes sense, right? Because of course, that is how the heart works when it's working on its own without a pacemaker. So they're trying that method more accurately, mimics the actual baseline function of the heart, right?
Correct.
Okay. So we've got these three types of pacemakers, and then I believe that any of them can either be just a pacemaker or can have an associated ICD, right?
Exactly. It's something that you'll just have to look either. You can see the shocking coil on an X-ray or when you look at the report. But if you're talking about transvenous technology, any of these can either be a standalone pacemaker or a combined ICD and pacemaker.
Okay. And is it, I've heard people say this, but it may well not be accurate, but people will sometimes say, you know, older people who've had them for a long time are more likely to have a standalone pacemaker, whereas people getting devices implanted more recently, they're more likely to be combined. Is that true, or is it completely patient dependent?
I believe that's true. Yeah.
Okay.
What Dr. Essendo is shaking his head over.
Mike, what do you think?
No, I mean, Tommy's right. It's one of those things that it's so variable. And even when you look at all the Heart Rhythm Society and, AHA, ACC guidelines, it's not clearly stated. So, I mean, if the patient has no indication for, let's say, defibrillation, or if they have an intact AV node. So they use a lot of considerations, and each hospital and each electrophysiologist basically implants device in a very variable way. But if somebody has, tachybrady syndrome or six sinus syndrome, and they're going to put a right atrial lead in, then they're going to get an isolated pacemaker and then depend on the AV node to basically take over after they pace in the right atrium and then provide, inherent biventricular pacing. But when a patient needs right ventricular pacing, and it's not, obviously I'm, an anesthesiologist, so, but if their EF is still marginal at best and they need RV pacing, it just makes sense to put a pacer with, defibrillation capabilities in there. So most of the isolated RV pacers would have defibrillation, capacity. And then also patients with almost all CRT, cardiac resynchronization therapy patients, potentially would have defibrillation because the criteria for CRT is, LV ejection fraction, the 30-35% range. And that's also a criteria for high risk in, ventricular tachyarrhythmia. So if you're going to put a CRT device in, it just makes sense to put a CRT with defibrillation capability. So I think it's still very personalized, but if it's an RV CRT, the majority of those patients would have, a defibrillation. But as Tommy was saying too, it just makes sense to just pay attention to the X-ray, because if the coil is there, then it has defibrillation, and not to just assume that just because a patient has, by V pacing, they have defibrillation.
Yep, totally. That sounds great. Thanks for that addition. All right. So, Tommy, let's talk about the letters themselves. Pacemakers have these what to someone who doesn't know would sound like just a complete gibberish code, right? But which actually is a fairly straightforward descriptor of what they do. So tell us about that.
Sure. And I think this is something that once you learn it, it's actually pretty straightforward. But you definitely have to review it a few times to kind of get it in your head and get it straight. But essentially, the coding letters are going to tell you what mode the pacemaker is in. And there's actually five letters, but really only the first three are the most important, really, that you need to concentrate on. And so I think the easiest way to remember the first letter is that this is a pacemaker. So the first letter is going to tell you what's being paced. And that could either be A for atrium, V for ventricle, D for dual, or O for no pacing. So again, the first letter is going to tell you what is being paced. The second letter is what chambers are being sensed. And it's the same as the first letter. It could either be atrium, ventricle, both, or none. And then the third letter is the response that the pacemaker is going to have to what it's sensing. So this can either be O for no response, T for triggered, and triggered means that the pacemaker is being triggered to pace. And then I would be inhibit, and that means that the pacemaker is going to be inhibited. So for example, if the pacemaker is, let's say, AAI at 70, that means it's going to pace the atrium, it's going to sense the atrium, And if the rate of the native heart goes above 70, then it will inhibit the pacemaker and it will let the heart do its own pacing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I think that's great. So let's use, I don't know, a couple of maybe common ones. So sure. You gave the example of AAI, right? So you're pacing the atrium, you're sensing the atrium. And if the inherent or the atrium itself beats, then obviously you wouldn't want the pacemaker to also do it. So it will inhibit itself. So that makes a lot of sense. What about, another common one people might see is DDD, right? So just maybe tell us a brief description of what that is.
So DDD is probably one of the most common configurations that you'll see. And that's always going to be for either a dual chamber pacemaker or a CRT pacemaker, because it involves sensing it. You're going to pace both the atria and the ventricles. You're going to sense them. And then the response can either be inhibiting the pacemaker or triggering. So I think a good example is, let's say a person has third degree heart block. They might be in DDD and you take them to the operating room. This is when this really becomes applicable to us, because if there's electric cautery that's too close to the device, the pacemaker is going to think that cautery is the heart beating at a fast rate. And then it's going to inhibit the pacemaker. Because the person has third degree heart block, there's not going to be any cardiac activity, any cardiac output, because the person has third degree heart block. So this is a really good example of when a pacemaker needs to be changed to a different mode if you're expecting there to be interference. For example, say like a chest surgery, because your cautery will be very close to the pacemaker.
Right. Okay. So that's super helpful and a great example of why this stuff really matters, because obviously if we're not careful in the operating room and a patient is pacemaker dependent, as you said, we could end up with a patient who is in asystole, which is obviously not a good thing. All right. So, and then, I think commonly people can, where these can get a little confusing, these letters, is, that third letter that is the response to sensing, if that's O, it doesn't mean the pacemaker isn't going to pace. It means it's not going to bother with a response to its sensing. So, for example, VOO is a pacemaker that is pacing the ventricle, but it's not sensing. And since it's not sensing, it's not responding to the sensing. And so you're just asynchronously pacing. So let's talk about that. What is asynchronous mode and how does that work?
So asynchronous mode would be a mode where, like you said, the third letter is going to be O, so it's not sensing and it's not inhibiting the pacemaker. So I don't want to get too political, but just think of your least favorite politician who, I don't know, maybe likes to fly off to the Caribbean or something, but they have no sense and no inhibition. And that's the same mode that this pacemaker is in. No sense, no inhibition. And it doesn't really care what the heart's doing. It's just going to keep pacing along at the same rate over and over again. And this is great for a pacemaker-dependent person when you're going to the OR and expecting interference. But the problem is if it doesn't care what the heart's doing, so if the native heart rate starts to go above what you're pacing at, then you're at risk for an RRT phenomenon, which, as we know, oftentimes results in VTAC or VFib, which no one likes to deal with.
Right. Not a good thing. So just to make sure people understand that. So what you're saying is that if, let's just say you're in VOO at, 60 for the sake of argument. All right. So your pacemaker is pacing at a rate of 60. If your heart rate is below that, then you're not going to have a heart rate, because the pacemaker itself is going to be inhibiting your own heart from beating. But if your heart rate goes above 60, then you're going to start having your own beats. And if the pacemaker fires, in other words, it's R wave, which is its firing. If that happens right on top of your native T wave, that's the R on T phenomenon that you mentioned, that can cause the heart to essentially devolve into VFib, right?
Correct. I like to think of the two O's in DOO and VOO as 007, because he has a license to kill. So you leave a patient in that mode after the surgery, that's like a license to kill them. So it's really important if you get a pacemaker change to DOO, VOO, you need to get a change back at the end of the case.
And would you say that it's probably not a good idea to set someone in an asynchronous mode at a rate that's low-ish, like I said, 60, is that, you know, that tends to probably be less safe. Would you set them at a little, you'd ask for them to be set at a little bit of a higher rate?
Yeah, definitely, I think. And especially when you're thinking of the increased cardiac demand when someone's undergoing surgery, you want them to be at a little bit of a higher rate.
Great, that makes sense to me. And as you said, you want them in this asynchronous mode so that the electric cautery can't stop the pacemaker, but you don't want to leave them in it after they're out of the OR because it's not necessary anymore since they're not going to have electric cautery happening to them outside the OR. And you are, as long as you're in this asynchronous mode, you're at risk for the potential complication of an RNT. So, all right. And then, you know, a lot of people are going to say, can't I just use a magnet, right? Won't putting a magnet just put me in asynchronous mode? Will it? Can I just use a magnet for this?
So it's important to make the distinction if you have a pacemaker or if you have a combined pacemaker ICD. If you just have a pacemaker only, a magnet generally should put the patient into asynchronous mode. But if you have an ICD and pacemaker, you will not change the pacemaker settings. You will only disable the ICD from shocking the patient. So it's important to keep that distinction in mind. Generally, I think it's, if you have the time, it's best to have someone come interrogate the pacemaker and change it just to be safer, because you run into the issues of the magnet falling off. If the patient's positioned laterally, for example, then you might have to worry about a pressure injury from the magnet. So in general, I like to try to recommend that you at least get it interrogated and changed if need be. But I think a magnet definitely can be helpful, for example, like in an emergency in the middle of the night.
Yeah. And, you know, we always teach our residents, and I would imagine you guys would agree, that even if you know it's only a pacemaker, you shouldn't just assume, unless you, you know, obviously, as you said, if it's an emergency, you don't have time. Okay, you're going to do the best you can. But if you've got the time to get interrogated, because you never know, right? There might be some, you know, a different, they might have some esoteric, you know, type of pacemaker that actually doesn't do what you think it's going to do in response to a magnet. So it's safer to just be sure.
Sure.
Hang in there. We'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
All right. So great. I think this was a really useful, and I just want to, that was focused, I think, appropriately on pacemakers. And so just briefly, in terms of ICDs, you said that a combination pacemaker AICD, one important piece is that it will do something different in response to a magnet, which, as you said, is that it's going to stop the anti-tachytherapy shocks, but it won't do anything to the pacemaker. But also, I think important to realize that, you know, you do need to deal with the anti-tachytherapy if you're concerned about electrocautery in the OR, right? Because you, even if someone's not pacemaker dependent, someone with an ICD has another potential complication from electrocautery, right?
Correct.
And what do we worry about with them?
So you're worried about inappropriate shocks. So even one shock really can cause damage to the myocardium. So it's something you really want to try to avoid. And that's basically the main concern from that standpoint.
Right. So the electrocautery can be read by the ICD as VTAC, and therefore it can shock, thinking it's treating VTAC, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that would be why you would want the anti-tachy therapy function disabled during an OR visit. And then briefly, you know, people will hear things like it depends on where the surgery is. So what are the guide, what do you kind of teach residents when they, when they're working with you, or what are you guys taught around, you know, is it below the umbilicus? Does that, is that the cutoff? When do we have to deal with getting the anti-tachytherapy turned off as opposed to not worrying about it?
I think most people go with below the umbilicus, but it's, there's not a lot of clear, super clear answers. And it can also depend on a lot of things, like if you're using monopolar or bipolar cautery. But in general, I think most people here are going by below the umbilicus. But if you're really concerned, it's probably better to be safe than sorry, and to just reprogram it to asynchronous if you're super worried.
Great. So people will hear if it's above the umbilicus, you do need it to get it reprogrammed. If it's below the umbilicus, maybe not. But I agree with you. If you're not sure, if it's right at the umbilicus, right, I think just be safe and get it reprogrammed. And then we will tend to, for people who have an ICD and are getting it disabled for surgery, we will tend to have that done as late as possible. So usually in pre-op as opposed to like the night before. And then we will keep pads on them, meaning the Zoll pads, through the period of time when their ICD is off, so that if they were to have an event, we would be able to very quickly shock them externally. Do you guys do the same thing?
For the most part, we do, yeah. And I think Dr. Essendo had something.
So that's an excellent point. Like historically, we've done the below the umbilicus, above the umbilicus for the transvenous systems, because the sensing of these transvenous leads are intracardiac. So they are quite resistant to, you know, EMI below the umbilicus. And, you know, Dr. Cody would bring this up later on when we talk about SICDs. The newer SICD is the only device that really senses the entire left hemithorax. And we'll get to that. So that, even though it's not addressed in our literature, I think it changes the impact of, you know, electromagnetic interference. Because if you're sensing the entire left hemithorax versus having a bipolar lead that is sitting just in the right ventricle, then EMI sensitivity, I think, is really high. And the SICD also shocks you at a higher energy level. And we'll get to that coming up. But I just want people to always think about it, that the ICD below umbilicus and above should be, they should consider which type of ICD it is, because it can be quite dangerous.
Great point. Thank you. And one of the, yet another reason why this episode is going to be really important, because with this new technology, we need to be thinking about this in a different way. So thank you, Mike, for bringing that up. All right. So Tommy, that was a great overview, and I think a great review for people. So Joe, let's turn to you now to talk about some of these pacing technologies that are now coming out to potentially replace, or at least have as an option other than transvenous technology. So tell us about what's out there.
So for the leadless pacemakers in the United States, there are two currently that are on the market. There's the Micra VR, that was approved in 2016, and the Micra AV, which was just approved in 2020. And there are a few others that you'll see in the literature that may be on the market, but they are not out yet. I'll mention them in passing, but not cover them too in-depth just because they're not on the market yet. But there's the NanoSim and the Empower. So those are two others. But for today, just because it's the one that's approved, I wanted to focus more on the Micra.
Yeah, great. So tell us, first of all, just tell me what the difference is between VR and AV, and then tell me what is this Micra VR AV?
So for the VR, that was sort of the first generation of the Micra, and it is a small device. It looks like a capsule. It's about the size of your fingertip. It is implanted in the RV by the EP cardiologist. EP cardiologist will access a femoral vein and use a transcatheter sister system to place it into the RV. And it's this small device that's permanently attached to the RV. It can sense and pace the RV, and that's its main feature. The population it was targeting was patients with atrial fibrillation was the main, because in those patients, you already lose AV synchrony. So they're sort of the perfect patient to just pace the RV. The micro AV had the addition of being able to sense what the right atrium is doing. Interestingly, with the standard transvenous pacers, there's an atrial lead and a ventricular lead, and it will say, and it can sense it that way. With the micro AV, there's no atrial lead. So it has an accelerometer that can sense the right atrium contracting, and that's how it maintains AV synchrony. So the perfect example would be a patient in a third degree heart block whose atrium will still contract, but it doesn't make it down the AV node. And so the micro AV can sense that and keep things in sync between the atrium and the ventricle.
That is really cool. So to make sure I understand you, this thing is now, first of all, they're going in through the venous system. And then so from the inside of the heart, they're kind of burrowing this thing into the myocardium. Is that right?
Yeah. So the device has these tines, and they go into the heart, and there is a special system that is made part of this full catheter, and these tines actually attach and they burrow into the heart, and with time they're actually the device itself becomes endothelialized to the inside of the RV.
Very cool. So there's actually no device exposed to the blood once it's
right.
Fully
exactly, and it's completely contained. There are no wires. It's a self-contained system with a bipolar lead and a battery, and it's all contained. And there's no pacer pocket. There's no generator site. There are no transvenous leads. It's all just this one small unit. Looks like a capsule.
Okay, very cool. And the way it's working, at least the AV version, you said, is that it actually can sense the change in motion or the movement of the atria and or the atrium and say, okay, because I can sense this motion, I now know the atrium just beat. And so, you know, in the absence of a ventricular beat to follow, I will provide that ventricular beat.
Exactly.
Okay, very cool. Now, the first thing that comes to my mind is, if it's buried in the heart, it obviously can't come out. It can't be accessed, right? It's going to be, as you said, epithelialized. It's going to be buried in the heart muscle. How do you change the battery?
So that's a great question. So it can come out. That's one choice. There was a case series actually done where they did successfully retrieve these micros. Or the alternative is if the cardiologist thinks it's safer, it can just be turned off and it can stay in the heart and a second one can be placed. So okay. And the battery life's pretty good. It's about 12 years or so for the battery life. So and that, okay, of course, depends on the pacing requirements of the patient and that sort of thing.
Okay. Now, how big is it? Like, give me an example. Are we talking the size of a dime, a quarter? What are we talking about?
It's about the size of a nickel, and it's 0.8 cc's and I forget how many grams. It's pretty small. I mean, if you take a look at a chest X-ray, it actually looks like there's like a small bullet in the RV. So,
okay. So. Great. So you're going to place this thing, and I'm actually amazed you can retrieve it, given that it's going to be buried in the heart. But I'm sure it's got some built-in mechanism for trying to kind of snag it. And I suppose you don't have to worry too much about bleeding on the inside of the RV, since it's the blood is only going to be joining the rest of the blood there. So the case series you mentioned, they did remove them, and it was safe to do that.
Yes.
Okay. So. We talked, Tommy went over for us some of the potential complications of the current transvenous devices. What are the potential complications? How does this compare to that?
I would say it's a very safe device. Immediate complications, I would say that the most concerning would be perforation of the RV or dislodgement of the device. So it could embolize into the pulmonary system. So those were reported in the initial studies, but they are rare. The most common complication is problems at the venous access site. So pseudo aneurysms and bleeding and that kind of thing from where the large sheath was placed in the femoral vein. So with regard to endocarditis and that sort of thing, which we see fairly frequently, more than we certainly want to with the transvenous leads, they haven't seen it with these micro devices. There have been cases of people with micros that developed prosthetic valve endocarditis, but the device itself was believed not to be infected.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that seems like a huge advantage of this, right, is that it's so self-contained that unless it goes in with an infection, it's probably very unlikely. And then once it's epithelialized, you'd think that even if someone got bacteremic, it would be very unlikely to be able to lodge on this device, right?
Yeah, and they actually studied, it was just a case series of patients who had endocarditis with a transvenous system, and they took out the transvenous system and a leadless pacer was placed in place of the transvenous system, and they did not get recurrence of their endocarditis. So okay, it does seem to show a protective benefit with safety there.
Okay. Now, does this require a larger insertion sheath than a traditional transvenous pacemaker?
Yes. I don't know the French, but it's a pretty decent size sheath. Yeah.
Okay. So then maybe that would lead to what you mentioned about insertion site complications as, you know, maybe like the most common form of complication. And then what about, you know, is there any issues around disrupting the native cardiac conduction fibers when you're implanting this into the wall? Is there, you know, are arrhythmias an issue?
I mean, not that I've seen, other than what you would expect when you're tickling the RV. I think it would be similar to if you're, doing a central line in your guide wire tickles the RV, or you're floating a Swan-Ganz catheter. So there's nothing I've seen other than those potential complications with regard to arrhythmia.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking was, like you said, if you've got a guide wire that's poking the RV and you get some PVCs or even VTAC, but then of course you just pull back your guide wire. In this case, that thing is not coming out, right? It's going to stay in there. But I'm guessing that if it caused a high rate of VTAC, we wouldn't be talking about it right now because it would have been approved. So it must be that maybe during insertion you can get some irritation, but that once it's there on its own, maybe it's small enough that it's not really causing these issues.
Yeah.
Okay. So great. So it's placed through a fairly large sheath. It's burrowed into the RV. It stays there. It's possible to retrieve, though it doesn't have to be. It can also be left there. If someone needs more than 12 years of pacing, then you can, or as you said, place a new one. Now, is there any thought, and maybe we'll turn to this when we kind of think about the future, but when I think about my Apple Watch, you know, I don't have to plug anything into it to recharge it, right? I just have to have it kind of up against this charger. Is there any thought in the future to whether you could recharge this thing by putting essentially some sort of recharger up against the patient's chest? Or is that kind of, are we talking about a little too far in the future?
I think it's a great idea. I haven't heard about that. I don't know if you've heard, Mike or Tommy, if you've heard anything about that.
No, but knowing how cardiac, you know, rhythm management advances, I bet you somebody's working on it, you know, currently. I know even for LVADs, because of the risk of driveline infections and the need to externally power it, there are companies, you know, working to advance it where you don't have to have an energy source come out of the skin. So right. there is a potential that, you know, I mean, it's just amazing how you can have something that little give you 12 plus years of pacing, which
that's right.
is remarkable. So, yes. Yeah.
I'm thinking, why are my car fobs not giving me 12 years, right? That's what I want to know. All right. So Joe, great. Anything else? I want to also ask you about the wireless CRT technology. But before we move to that, anything else you think we didn't cover about the Micra that we should go over?
Yeah, I think for these patients coming to the operating room, you have to take them very seriously. I think as Tommy had discussed with the transvenous pacers, I was sort of taught in training that, oh, I don't think we're going to have any trouble with the interference from electric cautery. If we do have a magnet in the room, we'll put it on. Well, with these micros, there's no response to the magnet. So you can put a magnet on the patient's chest. It's not going to do anything. So I think you have to really plan preoperatively the management of this pacemaker. And I think the ASA guidelines can be adapted for this, even though they don't specifically mention it. So I don't know if we have time to go through some of the things I think of when I see these patients.
Yeah, please, let's do it. I think that's really important.
So, if I see a patient with a Micra, I assume they're pacemaker dependent because they have a pacemaker, but I do make sure. And if they are dependent, I ask more questions. If they're not, I'm done and I take them to OR. And if they are dependent, I think things to consider are the surgical site. We do suspect that if it's below the umbilicus, you don't need to do anything. You keep it how it's programmed and you shouldn't have any interference. And the second thing is the type of the electric cautery. So if they're going to use a monopolar electric cautery and it's above the umbilicus and the patient is dependent on the pacer, it's probably as safest to change it to an asynchronous mode as we had discussed. So for the Micra, that would be VOO, which means it will pace the ventricle, but it doesn't sense or inhibit.
And so you can obviously still reprogram these, even though they don't have a pocket with a generator, but you can use they must hook up somehow with like radio frequency or Bluetooth or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, it's actually the same programmers that is for the transvenous. It's just a different application set. Yes.
Okay.
So there's like a wand and someone either from the vendor or the EP staff will come and they'll place over this wand and programmer, and they can change the settings that are appropriate for the patient.
Okay, great. So that's key, is that a magnet won't work. That's a real big difference. What else when you think about kind of how to handle these intraoperatively that's different than a traditional transvenous?
I would be cautious if the patient just had it placed and the guideline is within the 3 months or so, if you're going to float a swan or if you're in the CT surgery realm and they're going to get an RVAT, a Protec Duo, or an Impella RP, be very careful because you could knock off the Micra and it could embolize. So if it's a newer device, that's something to be cautious of. And I would even be concerned with a guide wire from a central line.
Yeah. Okay. So you got to be really careful. That's a good point. What about anticoagulation? Do these require anticoagulation when they're placed?
Not to my knowledge. Yeah. No.
Okay. So that's not an issue. And then when are there any indications? Is there anything that you would need a pacemaker for, but that this would not work for? In other words, are there indications that you'd say, oh yeah, no, you still need a transvenous pacemaker for this issue?
Yeah. I would say for somebody with a sinus node problem, so say their sinus node just doesn't work and their AV node is still transmitting, it would probably be better for them to have a dual chamber pacemaker. because if you were to put in a micro pacer, you would pace the RV, but you would lose the atrium. So I would say for a patient whose SA node doesn't work, this would not be the ideal pacemaker. It would work. It would keep them alive, but it wouldn't give them the advantage of the AV synchrony. Yeah, so that's probably the biggest one. And just to kind of state the obvious, but it's not an ICD. So if they need ICD therapy, it's not going to do that. So if you have a patient that would benefit from a pacemaker and from an ICD, you'd either have to do a standard transvenous ICD, or you have to combine the micro with a subcutaneous ICD. But it doesn't do that. And if you need CRT therapy, the micro by itself, it doesn't provide that resynchronization therapy. So right. It's a great device, but it has some limitations at this stage in the game.
Okay. So the big thing is that it only paces the ventricle, the right ventricle. So if you want to pace the left side, can't do that. If you want to pace the atrium, can't do that. So you need, it has to be for an indication where all you need to do is pace the right ventricle. And that, as you said, it can't do IC, it's not an ICD. Okay. So speaking of ICD, tell me about wireless CRT technology.
So,
speaking of ICD, we're going to get to that in a minute. Not ICD. Tell me, we talked about cardiac resynchronization therapy. Tell me about wireless CRT.
So CRT therapy is typically done with a third lead. So with a standard pacer that's placed by the transvenous route, they will typically place a lead in the right atrium, a lead in the right ventricle, and they'll do a third lead, typically to the coronary sinus. There are other ways to do this, but the most standard way are those three leads. The trouble is when a lead is placed in the coronary sinus, there are a few problems. It's a third lead, and as we discussed, these leads have complications. And B, the CRT therapy, despite being placed, the lead being placed in the coronary sinus appropriately, it doesn't always work. So that's sort of two downsides to the way that CRT therapy is being done now. There is a new technology out there called wireless CRT. And how that works is there is a very small electrode, looks like a pencil tip. I mean, it's real tiny. And it's actually placed into the LV. How the cardiologists do this is it's actually done in a retrograde fashion where they go through the arterial system. So we've been talking about the venous system for most of this podcast, but for this, the cardiologist will go on through the femoral artery. They'll cross the aortic valve, go into the LV, and place a small electrode. There's no battery to this. There's nothing. It's just a sensing. It's basically a receiver. And then it's linked, so subcutaneously, a battery and an ultrasound transmitter is placed in a subcutaneous pocket. So we're back to a pocket system. And there is a ultrasound transmitter that sends energy through an acoustic window that powers this lead. And it's triggered by a standard pacemaker or by a micro. It could be either. It's typically, if you take a look at the papers, it's a transvenous pacer, but it doesn't need to be. It just, it detects this pacing spike and then it paces. It sends power to this LV lead, and then it paces the LV at the same time as the RV. This is kind of different technology. I hope I summed it up okay.
Yeah, no, it, really interesting stuff. So it sounds to me like what you're doing is you're going to already have some sort of right-sided pacer. That could be a standard transvenous pacer, or it could be a Micra, which we just talked about. And then what you're doing is you're putting in a little tiny electrode into the LV retrograde, as you said, and then you're creating a pocket in the chest, which can do what sounds really neat, which is some, it's basically, it sounds very Star Trek to me, right? But it can like beam energy into that little electrode that's in now buried in the LV. And so tell me if I'm right here, what that little pocket is going to do, the device that's in the pocket, it's going to sense when the right-sided pacer fires, and it's going to basically tell the left-sided electrode that is it's associated with, hey, you should fire too. And therefore, you'll get your RV and LV fire, paced at the same time.
You're exactly right. That's perfect. And it's really great because it's shown to be more now. This is still kind of in studies. It's approved here for kind of a trial status. It's really not fully approved. But it's shown to be, it's promising to be more successful than the CS lead. So
it's instead of being in the coronary sinus and kind of having to, you know, hope for the best, you're actually in the LV this way.
Exactly.
Okay. Very cool. Now, is there anything, Perry, in the operating room that we need to be aware of when people have this? In other words, they've now got this pocket. We're back to, as you said, having a pocket and a little ultrasound radio frequency, you know, generator there. That is there anything unusual, anything we have to be careful of with electrocautery with that, any reprogramming of that side?
So we don't think so is the answer that I can give you. We don't really know enough. What we said in the paper was by changing the programming of the pacemaker to an appropriate pacing mode, the YCRT should follow that and everything should work out okay. Now, that being said, this is a newer device and we're still sort of learning. So.
Okay. I think of this like if I change my iPhone to airplane mode, my Apple Watch will follow and go to airplane mode too, right? So that
yes. Perfect. That's a perfect analogy. That's perfect, Jed.
Awesome. All right. Great. So I want to, since I already jumped ahead, I want to get to Tommy and talking about the SICD. But first, Joe, is there anything about either the micro or the wireless CRT technology that you think is important to cover that we didn't hit?
I think we covered the big points.
Okay, great. So Tommy, let's go back to you and tell me now about subcutaneous ICD technology. So we've talked here about wireless pacemakers and wireless CRT technology. How about subcutaneous ICD, which I'm guessing is also wireless?
Correct. So it basically is exactly what the name says. It's an ICD and it's implanted subcutaneously. So there's nothing in the venous system whatsoever. And these can be really great for, say, younger patients who have infection risk and you don't want to put a permanent device in transvenously, people who are very difficult venous access, like, for example, maybe a dialysis patient or patient with SVC syndrome. I think those are all kind of great examples of when the subcutaneous ICD would be a really nice option. But basically, it's composed of two parts. It has the generator itself, and that's put in the mid-axillary line, and then connected to that, and then tunneled. Basically, the left parasternal area is where the actual
the actual shocker.
Yeah, the actual shocker. Very scientific. And so it's all subcutaneous, just under the skin, except for the actual shocker. They are putting that sort of intramuscularly sometimes as well. With these, you can put a magnet on the generator part and it will disable it. So it'll actually beep concordant with the R wave for 60 seconds when you put the magnet on it. And after that, it will be disabled. The other option, like with all the other things, is that you can just have it reprogrammed to be off. So again, if you put a magnet on it, you have to worry about the magnet coming off. It's kind of in an awkward location, kind of over by the armpit. you also have to worry about pressure injury as well if you're going to put a magnet on that.
So when you say, so you put the magnet on, 60 seconds, it'll beep on the R wave. And then as long as the magnet is still on, it's off, or, and then if Correct. The magnet comes off, in theory, it is, it's back on.
Correct. As soon as the magnet's removed, it will come back on.
Does it do any beeping when it comes back on or no?
No, there's no,
okay.
No beeps when it.
Okay. So just when the magnet first goes on. Okay. So you can either put the magnet on, but then as you said, you got to really be careful to keep it on if that's your intention, or you can reprogram it. Okay. So this is the advantage of this, as you said, is there's no wires. Now I would imagine, but you tell me, that a potential disadvantage is it's not actually in the heart. So you probably have to use higher energy levels to make it work. And then is it less, you know, slightly less reliable since it's, you're, you know, not right there? Is this more like external pads than an internal defibrillator, or no?
Yeah, in a way it kind of is. And you're right. You do have to use a higher energy, and then it's further away from the heart. So if you have electrocautery, it's going to be more vulnerable to interference and inappropriate shocks. And another disadvantage, since currently it's still a standalone system, it can't provide anti-tachycardia pacing, which it's kind of more an advanced topic, but a lot of pacemaker ICD systems, instead of shocking right away, they can do anti-tachycardia pacing, which is supposed to be a lot better on the myocardium. If you can pace someone out of an arrhythmia, it's a lot better on the heart than defibrillating at a higher dose.
This cannot do that because it's not a pacemaker.
Correct. It's not connected to one yet. And also, if it does defibrillate, it can, you know, a lot of times after a defibrillation, the rhythm will be bradycardic and the transvenous system will pace for the bradycardia. But this subcutaneous ICD, it can do that, but only for, I think, 30 or 60 seconds. It can only do that for about a minute. So those are two disadvantages. There is a system being developed. By the way, there's only one SICD, and that's by Boston Scientific, and it's called the Emblem. Is that right? Yeah, Emblem MRI, which, of course, the name tells you that it's MRI compatible. But they are actually working on a system where their Emblem SICD will communicate with pacemaker system that they're developing.
So we may see the resolution of some of these issues when that comes about. The fact that you mentioned MRI, it makes me want to just double check with you guys about the Micra and the wireless CRT. Are those things MRI compatible?
I know for sure that the Micra is. For the YCRT, I believe that is too. Yeah,
I see Mike giving the thumbs up there. So it sounds like they are good. Okay, that's important.
Yeah, they all are. Okay, they all MRI compatible, especially the YCRT. You know, you put an electrode in the LV,
right?
So they made it 100% MRI compatible because dislodgement can lead to cerebral emboli. Yeah.
Yes, that would be a major issue.
Yeah.
These days, it's hard to imagine that anything would be made, any implantable device would not be made to be MRI compatible these days. But you never know. So I'm glad we've established that. Okay, so Tommy. We've got this ICD, the subcutaneous ICD. It's let's get back to the potential issue of it being more. It's closer to the surface. It's more sensitive to interference. So, as Mike said earlier, it's, you know, kind of sensing the whole left hemithorax. So you have to be really careful with maybe even with electrocautery below the umbilicus, right?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. So, is the recommendation that if someone has one of these? Really, and then they're going to electrocautery is going to be used. You should get this thing reprogrammed, really, no matter where the electrocautery is.
Yeah, I think in general that's the safest bet, and make sure you put pads on them once you disable it.
Okay, and let's just say that somebody has one of these. You get it disabled. You put pads on, and they do require a shock from your pads. Is there any potential damage to the device from that shock?
There could be damage for sure, and you need to get it interrogated afterwards. But you want to try to make sure you don't put the pads directly over the device as well.
Okay.
Which is the same as a normal transvenous pacemaker. You don't want the pads directly over the generator.
Right. And regardless, you want to get it interrogated it at the end to make sure it's still working correctly. Okay. Anything else from a kind of perioperative consideration perspective for the SICD that we didn't hit?
One other thing that I think actually there was an article that I don't remember if we include in our manuscript where there was a bystander, a patient of an SICD, bystander was helping with CPR. The SICD had, you know, sensed and detected VF. It delivered 80 joules and it hit the bystander. So for us in the operating room, if you have a patient with SICD and you're going to leave it on for shock therapies in the OR setting, you have to, for us anesthesiologists, we have to protect all the other stakeholders. So if a nurse, quote unquote, is not, or any of us is not wearing a glove per se, and you touch a patient or they are prepping the patient and the device senses things that there is, you know, ventricular fibrillation and it delivers that 80 joule, you may feel it, and that may not be a good time to get shocked when you're the only one on call middle of the night. So if you're going to leave the SICD on for shock therapies in the OR, like Tommy was saying, put a magnet on to disable it. When there's a true arrhythmia that you know, think needs therapy, when you take the magnet on, the device would detect it and shock the patient. Okay. And another consideration is certain drugs that we use, like, you know, myoclonus from Etomidate or fasciculations from succinylcholine. Obviously, the device may think that these are ventricular arrhythmias and it may shock at the same time. So just, you know, if you're going to leave it on, just try and suspend it with a magnet in place. Listen to make sure it beeps, but depending on the BMI of your patient, it may not be audible. You may have to use a stethoscope to really hear the beeping, but make sure it really has beeped. And when it beeps, as you know, Tommy said, the magnet has to stay exactly in the location where it suspended the shock therapy. So if it beeps and the magnet falls off and you put it back again, listen again. But because it's in the lateral aspect, we wrote that it's recommended that maybe put an IBAN, put a tegaderm, something to really keep it, the magnet in place, so you don't potentially get an inappropriate shock, which may be potentially dangerous to both the patient and, you know, the other operating room personnel.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, great. Thank you, Mike. And Mike, let me stay with you because I want to now ask you if there's anything you want to say to kind of wrap up. And then I'm also curious to hear from you about what's coming down the pike. We've heard some interesting stuff from both Joe and Tommy that we may see some combinations with the wireless or with the SICD and a pacemaker. Are there other things that you know of that are in the works or that we should keep our eye out for?
Yeah, so obviously, I mean, it was very – Tom and Joe did a phenomenal job talking about the functionalities of these newer devices. One of the problems that we encounter is these are all made by different companies, and they truly do not communicate with each other. So Medtronic, you know, makes, you know, the Micros, EBR makes the YCRT, Boston makes the SICD. We're seeing combinations of all these devices in the EP world. So there may be a patient that comes in and just needs a micro for pacing, but the ejection fraction is normal. And then 2-3 years later, because of RV pacing, now they develop, you know, dyssynchrony mediated heart failure with an EF of maybe 30%. And now that you add an SICD, you know, for defibrillation therapy, the problem is the micro does not communicate with the SICD. So this type of modular therapy is being done. And there's also, you know, a report of the YCRT being combined with the micro. So it just paces off of that. But so Boston Scientific is currently making the Empower leadless pacing system. And the rationale is to basically do the job that the micro does and then communicate with the SICD for defibrillation. Another functionality that they've provided in the Empower is the ability to provide anti-tachycardia pacing. Because as Tommy said, delivering 8 joules for any ventricular arrhythmia is too much because you're causing myocardial damage with all that energy. So if you have a leadless pacer that provides bradycardia, can sense ventricular tachycardia, which may either self-terminate or maybe terminate it with anti-tachycardia pacing. When the Empower is not able to provide that, then it would tell the SICD, I need a bigger shock energy to rescue the patient. And then post defibrillation, bradycardia is routine, it's very, you know, common. Currently, the SICD will pace you for maybe a minute, and then it stops because it's pacing you with 80 joules and it wants to preserve energy. However, when you add it to the Empower, now the Empower can provide longer-term bradycardia pacing. So modular therapy is here to stay. All the other companies are also working in this space. So Medtronic is actually doing it's got an extravascular defibrillator, which is going to be actually substernal. Now you're reducing the impedance. So the extravascular defibrillator would use lesser energy than the Boston Scientific SICD, but it would also have the potential to communicate with the Micra. So you have bradycardia pacing and defibrillation. So there is a lot coming in this space. The technology is rapidly, you know, evolving, and we will be seeing them. We'll be seeing these patients routinely because younger patients do not, you know, if anybody that has been in lead extraction, you damage valves, you occlude central vessels, the devices may need to be changed frequently, cardiac perforation, and especially with cardiac resynchronization therapy, needing three leads in a patient with the potential of not getting true efficacy. And even coronary sinus lead impede blood flow out of the coronary sinus, which obviously impacts negatively coronary perfusion. So there is a lot coming in this space from this standpoint of more, you know, what, you know, a lot of cardiologists term, you know, modular therapy. And one last point is patients with left ventricle assist devices frequently, obviously they have heart failure, they are prone to arrhythmias, they have transvenous devices routinely. A lot of centers, including ours, are now adding the SICD to LVAD patients so you can mitigate the transvenous infection risk that may potentially infect an LVAD. So we from the anesthesia standpoint, we have to be ready for this evolution. It does move so fast. Just when you think you've mastered one of them, a new one comes because the Micra came, and before we knew what was happening, Micra AV came. And now why CRT is, you know, being accelerated. And so we can't wait for quote unquote true guidelines. We just need podcasts such as yours. We really appreciate what you're doing in this space so we can share this knowledge with others. And then we can also grow, you know, together to make, obviously to improve patient care globally.
Yeah, no, I absolutely totally agree. And we'll have to do a follow-up episode when the next version comes out, because I'm sure it won't be long. And we absolutely should. All right. So, you know, I think in summary, right, there are new technologies. They're happening more and more. It sounds like there's reasonable data that they're, you know, at least as safe, if not better in some ways. Obviously, for example, you're not dealing with a lot. You don't have any of the transvenous complications around obstruction of vessels and, you know, potential infection. So you actually are better in some ways. There are some limitations. We talked about those. But because these have some advantages, we're going to be seeing them more and more. And so anesthesiologists are going to need to know how to deal with them. And there are some major differences, like the fact that the Micra doesn't respond to a magnet, right? I mean, that's just one obvious example that if you didn't know, you could really be in trouble. All right. Well, anything else, Joe, Tommy, or Mike, that you want to bring up before we move on?
I don't think so.
No, thanks.
All right. I think this has been fantastic. So let's turn to the portion of the show where we do random recommendations. I left it up to you guys whether you wanted to each do your own or whether you wanted to have a joint recommendation. And you have kept me in the dark, so it's going to be a surprise for me. But before we get to you guys, let me bring in an audience shout out. Laura Cochran wrote in to say that she actually has been working for a new publication. It's called Neo.life. It covers the emerging neobiological revolution, everything from gene editing to the future of food and all kinds of interesting stuff. And she recommended an article they had written that I checked out. And it was really interesting. It was about alarm fatigue in the ICU. We'll put the link in the show notes, but some really interesting thoughts. And for example, they talk about kind of the ICU monitors of the future, which would be one monitor that records everything, heart rate, blood pressure, pulse ox, and it all filters into one computer together so that rather than one individual thing being off, in other words, you know, if the patient appears to have V-fib, but they have a totally normal blood pressure, then the thing wouldn't alarm because there's no way they're in V-fib with a blood pressure of 120 over 80. And so it would integrate all of the different signals and then decide whether there needs to be an alarm and help eliminate some of the alarm fatigue by eliminating the quantity of false positive alarms. So pretty interesting. And check out that article from neo.life. All right, gentlemen, back to you. What did you decide?
I mean, I have my own.
Tommy has one. Joe has one.
Tommy, go first. let's hear. I love it. Our audience will love to hear what each of you recommend. What do you have to shout out for them?
You wanted a book, right? And
could be a book, a movie, a recipe, whatever you want.
I mean, probably my favorite show is The Office. Like, if I'm having a bad day, I'll pull up Dwight versus Jim clips, and that always puts me in a good mood.
Nice.
All the pranks and stuff.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Love it. Great recommendation.
Well,
Joe or Mike?
I'm in Ohio with my colleagues here, and it's been a cold winter. And I'm thinking about where before I was here, I lived in Pittsburgh, and it's not really a big city. It's not a New York City. For people who are international, you may not think to visit Pittsburgh, but I would encourage anyone, if you're in the neighborhood or driving by, stop in Pittsburgh in the summertime and rent a kayak. And there are three big rivers in Pittsburgh, and it's real introductory kayak. If you've never done it before, it's a real peaceful way to enjoy a spring or summer day. So, as this winter season ends, I would, if you're by Pittsburgh, stop there and rent a kayak and check out the views on the three rivers.
That's awesome. Thanks, Joe. That sounds like a lot of fun. Mike, how about you?
Well, I'm not as exciting as these guys. I'm kind of I'm kind of like a boring guy. But I was just hoping, I just wanted to get more of a reach, like a broader audience through your podcast, and try to get the societies to get, we assembled six centers, but five or six, I guess. But even though we reviewed the literature and then basically selected, Joe, and I would say this, Joe and Tommy were phenomenal in getting this article done. As an attendant, I get some credit, but I would say they were phenomenal getting this done.
Sure.
But it's still like globally, if any anesthesiologist is going to care for a patient with quote unquote a cardiac rhythm monitoring device, they're going to pull our guidelines. And it just is not, to be politically correct. I think it's not comprehensive enough when probably 30% of the devices in that space were not quote unquote directly addressed. So if we can find a way for Heart Rhythm Society, Society of Cardiovascular Anesthesiologists, and the ASA to just get a group together. It's not always going to be randomized trials, because how do you even design such a trial? A patient has a micro. I'm going to say, for you, we're going to turn it off. For you, we're going to leave it on. We just need some guidance, and it has to be a large volume, because it's in Europe, the YCRT is approved. So they're using it, commercially. We're not here, so we just have to get a broader mass, get a critical mass of anesthesiologists to just create a document. Just, even our transmitters documents were not based on randomized trials. It was just based on expert opinions, people with a lot of experience in this space. So if you can make this happen, it would help a lot of patients, because there's nothing worse than being on call middle of the night and routinely you're trying to figure out, that a pulse generator pocket should be in the left infraclavicular space. Now you look, it's not there. Maybe they may have a micro, they may have a YCRT, and losing, the number one driver of the patient's functionality, which is the heart, I think can be detrimental. So we got to get this done.
Yeah, I love it. So Mike's random recommendation is to recommend that people get their act together and do better guidelines. And I'll tell you, not only I love it and I agree with you, Mike. And I'll say, you know, not only do we need more guidelines, but when we have them, we need them to be easier to digest quickly. In other words, half the time I feel like you pull up one of these guidelines and you're just trying to find the answer to a simple question, like, what should I do with this patient? Do they or do they not need further cardiac workup before surgery? And there's no easy summary page where you can just go and say, oh, there it is. There's no infographic. There's nothing easy. You have to read through, and it's talking about all the different levels of evidence, and it's talking about, you know, what this and that. And it's almost impossible to find the actual recommendations, right? So I would say to these societies, not only do more, but when you do them, make it something with a very straightforward summary page that tells practitioners, here's what to do in a given situation.
You're 100% correct. And one of the authors that was did a phenomenal job in our paper with creating such a table, Dr. Nasser Hussain, he's our chief resident. We didn't have enough space for him here, so we have to still give him a shout out. But he created a table of all the functionalities of the micro AV, CRT, all the devices that we discussed in our article. So in the middle of the night, if you just pick up our article and you just get to that one page, you can at least manage the patient and then read the whole document, you know, later on. So yep. NASA did a great job.
That is awesome. All right. Well, love the recommendation. And mine, on a totally different note, listeners will know that I'm a fantasy novel fanatic and I was looking for something new. I decided not to read Brandon Sanderson's new book because I want to wait till that series, the Stormlight Archives, is done before I read another one and then have to wait for years for the next. So I was looking for something and I just was Googling and reading various Reddit pages to try to figure out. And several people recommended the Riria, which is spelled R-I-Y-R-I-A, the Riria Revelations by Michael J. Sullivan. And I'll tell you, I am about two-thirds of the way through. It's fantastic. There's three books, but each one is actually made up of two kind of sub books. The backstory is fascinating. He actually initially wrote these, I think, for his son and tried to get them published, and kind of no one was interested in publishing them. So he self-published them because his son refused to read them if they were just like dad's printed out manuscript. He said, I'm only reading it if it looks like a real book. So his dad like self-published them, or the author self-published them so that it would look like a real book. Gave them to his son and then also kind of gave them around, and they caught on fire. He ended up selling like tens of thousands of copies. And then, of course, all of a sudden, publishing houses took interest. And he's now a really well-regarded, famous fantasy author who's made it big because they're incredibly entertaining, well done. So if you're into that kind of book, if you like Game of Thrones, you like Brandon Sanderson stuff, I think you will like Michael J. Sullivan's stuff and start with the Riria Revelations. All right, guys, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This was
we
fun.
Appreciate it.
All right. That was fantastic. I know it was a long one, but I think a really great one. A lot of really good stuff in there. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com. You can leave a comment and others can learn from what you have to say. If you want to join the conversation on Twitter, I'm at Jay Wolpaw and we're at Acrac Podcast. And of course, you can also join the Facebook group. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasting, leaving a comment and a rating. It helps others find the show. If you're interested in supporting the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. And even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make individual donations anytime you want by going to paypal.me/acrac or looking for Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thanks so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Big thanks, as always, to Dr. Brian Park, our tech lead, to April Liu, who is our social media manager, and Dr. Kimmy Akash-Cooley, who helps out with some of the show notes. Big thanks to Dr. Dennis Kuo, who composed our original ACRAC music, and his website is studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Drs. SN Doe, Cody, and Grawl, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.